You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2021, January 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Down to Earth by Nick Bilton. If Jassy is described today as a nice guy, his former boss was once seen that way, too. While Bezos spent the first two decades as head of Amazon, coming across as Jassy does today, unpretentious, with his own dowdy shirts and frumpy khaki pants, driving an old Honda Accord when he was worth $10 billion, and venerating his wife and family, something seems to have changed in Bezos as his wealth, power, and fame grew. In January 2019, Bezos announced he was divorcing his wife of 25 years, Mackenzie Scott, and he is now rumored to be engaged to Lauren Sanchez, an entertainment reporter and helicopter pilot. Since then, Bezos has gone through a sweeping physical transformation, trading that bumpkin-like style for leather jackets and puffer vest. Many people speculate he has plumped up his lips and cheeks and possibly had some sort of cosmetic surgery. His Accord was swapped for a $70 million Gulfstream G650ER private jet. His ostentatious lifestyle will go down in history. He owns homes in Washington, D.C., $23 million, two mansions near Seattle, $63 million, an apartment in New York City, $80 million, a compound in Los Angeles, $175 million, and a 30,000-acre ranch in Texas. He's one of the largest landowners in America, according to the Land Report, and he is currently building a $500 million, 417-foot superyacht, which will have its own little baby yacht. Then there is his obsession with space. One media publisher told me he saw Bezos as a man going through a midlife crisis on a lunar level. A current Amazon employee said, "Jeff seems to have left the planet, literally and figuratively." Unlike Jassy, Bezos's philanthropy seems to be tepid at best. While his ex-wife, Scott, has given away more than $8 billion since their divorce, under Bezos's leadership, Amazon opposed a nominal tax in Seattle that was intended to help the city's homeless. Years ago, it was Bezos's decision to stop giving automatic raises to hourly workers in the fulfillment centers after 3 years, according to Brad Stone's new book, Amazon Unbound, with Bezos justifying the action as a way to stop employees from becoming complacent. And under Bezos, there were no air conditioning units at a warehouse in Pennsylvania until 2012, even while some employees were reportedly fainting from extreme heat. In the face of millions of people who lost their jobs due to the pandemic, Bezos chose to take a tourist flight on a Blue Origin spacecraft this summer, and after landing successfully in perhaps his most tone-deaf moment thus far, he thanked every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer because you guys paid for all this. So how is it, given that Bezos could have chosen anyone on the planet to appoint as the next CEO of Amazon, he chose almost his polar opposite to run the company? Well, it seems that was the point. In early 2010, Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple, made a secret pilgrimage to a handful of newsrooms across the country to talk candidly about his business. In one such meeting at the New York Times with a group of editors, I sat across from Jobs as he talked about the iPad and his competitors. Curiously, Jobs said he worried about Google encroaching on Apple's turf, but he did not worry about Microsoft. When I ask why, Jobs said, when Bill Gates stepped down, he put a sales guy in charge of the company, and the only way to ruin a company is to have a sales guy running it. What he should have done is put a product guy in charge. The sales guy Jobs was referring to was Steve Ballmer, a boisterous Pierrot who would end up missing one opportunity for Microsoft after another, the smartphone, the tablet, social media. It wasn't until Microsoft replaced Ballmer with Satya Nadella, a product guy, in 2014 that Microsoft started to flourish, growing into a $2.2 trillion company. Choosing a successor can be one of the most difficult decisions a CEO makes, especially for a business still run by its founder. The right choice can mean astounding growth and a legacy for the history books. The wrong one, the near annihilation of a company. Jack Welch, for example, who ran GE from 1981 to 2001, was considered one of the greatest CEOs of his generation, amplifying the company's market capitalization from $14 billion to $410 billion by the time he retired. The tenure of his successor, Jeff Immelt, led GE to near collapse, its stock falling 30% as the S&P 500 rose by 124%. Immelt famously had an extra private jet follow his primary private jet when he traveled in case he ran into delays, even as GE laid off thousands of workers. When Jobs stepped down as CEO of Apple in 2011, he didn't follow his own advice because he couldn't find a product guy who was also a business guy. So instead, he chose to appoint Tim Cook, whom Jobs had once described as not a product guy, to run the company, and Joni Ive to design the products. According to an advisor to Jobs at the time, Jobs knew that Cook, an operations genius, would be able to grow Apple with its product line into a global behemoth. Indeed, Jobs was right again. Apple is now worth $2.55 trillion and is the biggest company on the planet. For Bezos, the decision was different. Amazon could tell it was potentially in serious trouble over the last couple of years as Donald Trump found one topic on which to agree with his extreme antipodes in government. Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that Amazon was too big and needed to be put in check. Ocasio-Cortez has accused Bezos of paying his workers starvation wages. Sanders has slammed Amazon and talked up the need to take a look at the power and influence that Amazon has. And Trump, while in office, inveighed against Bezos, Amazon, its power, and tweeted that they pay little or no taxes to state and local governments. Last year, Bezos was hauled before the House Subcommittee on Antitrust, Commercial, and Administrative Law, which turned into essentially 5 hours of lawmakers berating Bezos and the heads of Alphabet, Facebook, and Apple for their anti-competitive monopolistic practices. And that was just the start. The Federal Trade Commission is currently investigating Amazon's business practices around snuffing out competition in retail and Jassy's AWS division. The company also faces antitrust inquiries by attorneys general in New York and California, and the Department of Justice is looking into a broad antitrust review of big tech. That's just in the United States. India, the United Kingdom, and Germany, among others, are probing Amazon for antitrust issues. In June, a bipartisan bill was proposed in the House that would effectively force Amazon to be split in two or close down its private label businesses, in which the company makes its own branded products. The peak of all of this for Amazon is obviously yet to come, with investigations, bills, and hearings just heating up. But back in 2018, as he was firing up the rocket boosters on his lunar-level midlife crisis, according to one person close to the company who knows Bezos and Jassy, Bezos foresaw what the next decade for Amazon would look like and knew that not only did he want to pursue other passions, but most important, he was no longer the right person to be the face of the company. Even Bezos had the self-awareness to recognize that the richest man on the planet, who owns more than $1 billion worth of homes, planes, and yachts, whose laugh evokes Dr. Evil, would not be the best witness to place in front of Congress when arguing that Amazon is indeed not an antitrust threat and a monopoly, and that it does not pay its employees starvation wages. There was really only one other person at Amazon, a true blue Amazonian, who was not only capable of running the entire empire, but also came across as a nice, unthreatening guy, just like you and me. Andy Jassy. Jassy is already formulating how he will respond to these issues in front of Congress. His answers to me on these topics were buttoned up and articulate, media-trained, and ready for prime time. In our retail business, if you look at the size of business relative to the global retail market, we have about 1% of the total global business, Jassy told me, when I ask how he plans to respond to Congress. It's a big business, and Walmart is a larger retailer than Amazon, but still, we only have about 1% of the global retail market share. Will these statistics be enough to stave off a battalion of government lawyers trying to break up Amazon? Probably not. But there have long been rumors in business circles that Amazon actually wants to be broken up. AWS could be one of the top 10 biggest businesses on the planet if it was spun out of Amazon, an investor told me. If the government breaks them up, they will just make more money. The government thinks they're so smart threatening to do this, but it's what Amazon wants. While Amazon might be fine being broken up, one thing it definitely does not want is to be unionized. The company has a history of harassing employees who even discuss unions in its fulfillment centers, including, reportedly, spying on organizers. Many of these issues came to a head earlier this year in Alabama, where after a long and very public struggle, warehouse workers ultimately voted against unionizing, following an aggressive pushback from the company, including mandatory information sessions and an anti-union text message campaign. Jassy's got the union talking points down pat, too. He rattled off a list of all the things Amazon has done around safety and improving employee pay. We pioneered, especially in the United States, raising the minimum wage to at least $15 an hour with full benefits, insurance, 401k, and 20 weeks of maternity leave, he told me. He used that old line that unions are not up to him but to the Amazon workers, but also confessed he believed that unions might not be best for Amazon's business. Personally, he said with a brief pause, I think the thing about a union is that it just makes it harder to move faster and to be nimble. Stuart Applebaum, president of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, told me that in 2019, when Amazon was exploring opening its second headquarters in New York City, it was the possibility of a union that was stalling the effort. On a bitterly cold Wednesday afternoon, then-Governor Andrew Cuomo called a meeting with the top brass of Amazon, people who reported to Bezos. A group of union leaders, including Applebaum, and other government aides in his conference room in New York. Cuomo desperately wanted Amazon to set up HQ2, as it was called, in New York City for the potential job opportunities, and he was determined to broker a deal between Amazon and the unions. After hours of negotiations, the two groups agreed to a middle ground, which Applebaum described as a weak deal, but it was one we all agreed on, that would allow organizers to start a tepid union at best, and in which Amazon agreed not to retaliate against people who wanted to unionize. "We all shook hands and agreed on the deal," Applebaum told me. Then, the next morning, Bezos announced he was walking away from New York. When I asked if union organizers he had spoken to believed Jassy would act the same way, Applebaum laughed. "It's still Jeff Bezos' company, and all major decisions are going to be run by him, no matter who has the title of CEO," he said. Being CEO of one of the biggest companies in the world was never a dream job for Jassy. After growing up with two very normal parents, his father was a lawyer, his mother a trustee at a theater company in Scarsdale, New York, Jassy made his way to Harvard with one hope, and one hope only, to be a professional athlete. He first played tennis, then soccer, but when he realized in college that he simply didn't have the build or skill to play professionally, he was determined to stay in sports. He tried to be a radio sportscaster. When that failed, he tried to be a TV sportscaster, which also failed. He then tried to manage a rock band, which didn't work out either. And finally, he worked for a collectibles company selling porcelain keepsakes. These failures ultimately led him to business school at Harvard and, by chance, to Amazon. In 1997, when Jassy was at Harvard Business School, an Amazon recruiter was unable to fill her interview slots because so few people at the university knew what Amazon was, so she cold-called Jassy after finding his resume in the career office. More than two decades later, Jassy told his wife he thought he'd only last 3 years in Seattle. Sports has remained a mainstay of Jassy's passions. Sports are so important to him, in fact, that he built a sports bar in his basement that he calls Helmet Head, which, he likes to brag, has 7 TVs. He's so obsessed with sports that when I went through years of his likes on Twitter, I found videos and tweets about baseball, basketball, college basketball, football, college football, volleyball, soccer, mountain biking, golf, even wiffle ball. And he even liked a couple of tweets about locker rooms. But while he gave up playing sports, at least professionally, that competitiveness never really left him. And perhaps the competitive streak is what got Jassy where he is today. During our conversation, the two times he seemed to get most excited were when he talked about the importance of customers. He said customer dozens of times in a one-hour conversation, uttering corporate poetry like, "We're pretty clear-minded that for us we exist to help solve problems for customers and to make their lives better." And when he talked about Amazon's competitors, "You always want competition," he said with a little extra pep in his voice. "It's good for consumers, it's good for opportunities, and it's good for the economy." Indeed, Jassy makes everything a competition. His sister told me that when he was 6, he was so intent on winning board games with her older friends that he obsessively studied the rules of Monopoly and Clue, then mastered the games, just so he could take on and beat her 10- and 11-year-old friends. He used to invite co-workers into his office each morning to play a game he called The Ledge, where Amazonians would stand across from one of Jassy's many whiteboards and try to land a dry erase marker on the ledge. He kept a running scoreboard behind his door, and everyone, and I mean everyone, I spoke to about Jassy spent a good portion of the conversation talking about Jassy's wing-eating contest, which he calls Tatanka, named after the word for buffalo in the movie Dances with Wolves. The annual competition, which Jassy originally hosted at the Wing Dome restaurant in the Greenwood neighborhood of Seattle, includes wing referees who wear black and white striped jerseys to inspect bones for any leftover meat, and offers a vegetarian segment with celery sticks. In typical Jassy fashion, he created competitions within the competition. One of these is where participants weigh themselves before and after the tournament to see who has gained the most weight during the contest. Rick Dalzell, who worked with Jassy for 2 decades at Amazon, told me that he once watched Jassy, so intent upon winning, eat so much that he ran out of the room because he was going to vomit. Jassy has clearly used that competitive streak to grow AWS to the behemoth it is today, and is now going to try to make Amazon the biggest retailer on the planet. From people I've spoken to at the company, it appears that Amazon has hopes of overtaking Walmart sometime next year, as well as trying to stave off lawmakers. But at what cost? Will Jassy be so obsessed with winning that he's oblivious to the plight of women and underrepresented groups at Amazon? Will he be so concerned with moving fast and remaining nimble that he pushes workers in fulfillment centers until they faint and have to be taken out on stretchers so that we, his darling customers, can get a roll of toilet paper more quickly? Will he be okay with delivery drivers urinating in bottles in order to meet their quotas? Will he shrug his shoulders and appear publicly not to give a shit, as his predecessor did, when he continues to destroy Main Street and mom-and-pop shops even more than Amazon already has? Will he still be a nice guy, or, as happened to someone he knows so well, will he change? Toward the end of my interview with Jassy, I noted that in many respects, he looks a lot like Bezos did when he started as CEO of the company back in 1994. Unpretentious, unaffected by money, and not yet world famous. I pointed out that over the past 2 decades, tech titans like Zuckerberg, Jobs, Bezos, and Gates have become household names. Over the next 5 years, Jassy will become one of them. He will be on the cover of newspapers and magazines. His face will be projected across television screens around the globe. He will become a superstar. When you have that amount of wealth and that amount of fame, and you have everything, it affects you, I said, pointing to what's happened to people like Gates, whose marriage fell apart because of his philandering, or Jobs, who thought he knew better than his doctors and refused a potentially life-saving surgery in favor of a fruitarian diet. I wonder if he thought, perhaps presciently, that being the CEO of Amazon will change him as it clearly did Bezos. Does that worry you? Do you think it will change you in any way? I ask. He thought for a brief moment and then told me, "It does not worry me. Mostly because I think I know who I am. I know that there are a number of things I haven't encountered, and I'm sure I'll encounter over time," he said. "But I feel grounded in who I am and what matters to me, and I'll remain true to that. One thing is for sure, the entire world will be watching." Eyes on the Prize, by Alexis Okeowo, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. America's most famous public intellectual is also one of its most besieged. As a book version of the 1619 Project hits shelves and the right wing rails against teaching racial justice, Nicole Hannah-Jones takes stock of the national legacy she is building. Opening photo, School of Thought. Nicole Hannah-Jones in the Founders Library at Howard University. Nicole Hannah-Jones is tired, excited, and grateful, too, but the last 2 years have sometimes been dark and often exhausting. Her groundbreaking work, the 1619 Project, ignited a fight over who will tell the story of this country and how we think of its identity. But before we could collectively re-examine the legacy of American slavery, then-President Donald Trump said the project warped, distorted, and defiled the American story. School boards around the nation banned teaching it, likening it to the widely misunderstood legal philosophy known as critical race theory. As the creator and public face of the project, which includes contributions from acclaimed reporters and essayists, Hannah-Jones has received, along with the praise, the brunt of the hate. Her name has become a cultural signifier of the power of investigative journalism, or a dog whistle to the politicians and commentators who use her life's work as evidence of a conspiracy to take the country away from white people. On an overcast Sunday afternoon at her home in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, she is signing inserts that will be placed in the first editions of the 1619 Project, A New Origin Story. The anthology, out this month, is an expanded version of the New York Times Project, with longer essays, new fiction, and poetry, and writing on topics like Indian removal and the Haitian Revolution. The night before, she was in Iowa, filming a 1619 documentary series for Hulu. The next day, she is heading to Alabama. We settle on the dark blue couch in her living room, and she balances a pile of inserts atop a Kehinde Wiley book on her legs. Her curly stop sign red hair is pulled back into a bun, and she is wearing a gold nameplate necklace and a stretchy black knit dress. Her 11-year-old daughter is curled up in a chair across from us, half watching the television and half watching her mom. Hannah-Jones and I have known each other for years, but I haven't seen her since the summer of 2019 at the launch celebration for the 1619 Project at the New York Times office in Midtown Manhattan. Since then, the MacArthur Genius Grant winner has won more journalism prizes, trained more editors and reporters of color through the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting, which she co-founded in 2016 at the University of North Carolina, and become friends with Oprah. Hannah-Jones, 45, grew up the middle of three sisters in the manufacturing town of Waterloo, Iowa, with her black father, Milton, who variously managed a convenience store, drove a school bus, and worked at a meatpacking plant and as a hospital orderly, and her white mother, Cheryl, a state probation officer. Milton had come to Iowa from Mississippi as a young child. His mother was the first of her family to migrate. Cheryl was raised in rural Iowa by parents who had also grown up there. The two met when Milton, recently discharged from the military, was visiting the campus of the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, where Cheryl was a student. I actually asked my mom about this recently, and she was looking out the window of her dorm and sees my dad and goes down and hurls herself at him, Hannah-Jones says, laughing. I tell her that I was surprised to learn years back that she was biracial. Well, she says, smiling, that's probably curated. She has never identified as a person of mixed race. I clearly know that I'm biracial. I have a very close relationship with my mom, despite my grandparents being conservative, rural white people who liked Ronald Reagan and were vehemently opposed to Obama. They were very good grandparents to us, as long as we just didn't talk about race, she says. I would say, very young, my dad sat my sisters and myself down and told us that our mom might be white, but we were black, and we were going to be treated in the world as if we were black. Like the children in segregated public school districts she has written about, Hannah Jones was bused from her black neighborhood to mostly white schools, and in those schools, she had her first political and social awakenings. Busing was a common experience in the Midwest and South for black kids. Growing up in Alabama, I was assigned to be bused from my black neighborhood to a white elementary school, and it could be a lonely and alienating one. I get this from my mom, but I've always sided with the underdog in general, Hannah Jones says, and being bused led me to be a very angry high school student. About a fifth of the kids at her school were black, and nearly all of them were bused and not allowed to forget it by classmates, teachers, and disciplinary policies that favored white students when they got into fights with black ones. Hannah Jones was one of a few black kids in her advanced classes. All of the basic math and science classes were full of black students. Hannah Jones had her school friends, and she had her neighborhood friends. Most of her aunts and uncles from Milton's side of the family lived within a few blocks. And she had a close relationship with Cheryl's parents. Her grandparents had disowned Cheryl for a time, but changed their minds when Hannah Jones's older sister was born. Hannah Jones was precocious as a girl, nerdy and observant, and noticed differences in the way she felt with the two sides of her family. It was clear to me that when I was with my black family, I was just one of them. And when I was with my white family, I was part of them, but could never be fully of them. I could be black, but I could never be white. There's not any tragedy about it. She read a lot, to learn about the world and to escape her father's alcoholism. Milton could be verbally abusive, and the two clashed often. She read historical fiction and encyclopedias, and her parents' Louis L'Amour and Danielle Steele novels, especially when she was grounded. I got in trouble a lot, she recalls. I had a smart mouth. I talked back a lot. Cheryl says that Hannah Jones was mischievous as a kid, but studious. She was very much in tune to what was going on in the world. In middle school, she asked for a Globe for Christmas and wanted a subscription to Newsweek magazine, Cheryl recalls. She's always had very strong feelings about things. It was Cheryl who took her daughters to their first civil rights protest. During her sophomore year, Hannah Jones took a black studies class from the only black male teacher she would have, Ray Dial, and started to learn about black culture and politics in a way she never had before. It felt exciting. Hannah Jones was reading about apartheid and Sheikh Anta Diop's The African Origin of Civilization, and listening to De Lynch Mob and Ice Cube. She wore a Malcolm X medallion. She complained to Dial that the school newspaper never wrote about the experiences of black students. He told Hannah Jones to join the paper or stop complaining about it. So she joined. Her column was called From the African Perspective. The first piece was on whether Jesus was black. I was intentionally trying to be provocative, Hannah Jones says. I did a lot of writing about what it was like to come from the black side of town and go to a white school. And that's what I won my first journalism award for, from the Iowa High School Press Association. From there, I was kind of hooked on wanting to be a journalist and write about the black experience. Outside of the paper, she and her best friend helped start a cultural enrichment club that was designed to be black-led. To promote the first meeting, they put up posters that compared the United States to apartheid-era South Africa and hung white and colored signs above the water fountains and bathrooms. When school began, they went ballistic. They took down all our signs and they canceled our first meeting, Hannah Jones says. laughing again. She was starting to feel a sense of power from what she could get done with writing and activism. And she was energized from learning a black history. All this time, when I thought black folks hadn't done anything, that had been kept from her. She decided to study history and African American studies at the University of Notre Dame. Hannah Jones found the elite environment of Notre Dame even more alienating than her high school, but she knew having a prestigious degree would help her career. Next photo, beloved. Hannah Jones and her daughter, Naya, outside their Brooklyn home. After getting that degree, she worked as an admissions counselor at a school in rural Indiana, part-time at Subway, and then as a receptionist and a salesperson at Macy's, before going to journalism school at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She saw me first, and she gave me the look, the eye that black people give each other when they are the only ones in the space, that kind of, like, I see you. And I saw her, and I gave her the look back, her longtime friend Joy Harrington says. Her worldview was readily apparent. What you see is what you get. There's no guile. There's no subterfuge. I thought she was one of the smartest people I had ever met. Harrington said she ended up learning more about the history of institutional racism from Hannah Jones outside of class. In her first journalism jobs at the Chapel Hill News and the News and Observer, Hannah Jones started writing about housing and school segregation. She also worked at a mattress store, because I don't like to be broke. She met Faraji Jones, who works in information technology, on AOL Instant Messenger. The two married, and they moved to Portland, where she joined the Oregonian. Hannah Jones nearly left journalism during those 6 years. She says the newspaper had promised her the freedom to write about race, but instead she was accused of being biased if she did, or was not allowed to. Still, she stayed. I derived so much life's purpose out of the work that just going somewhere and doing something else for a paycheck, I just couldn't fathom it, she tells me. In 2011, she went to ProPublica, where she began her influential reporting on segregation in American public schools. What I consider to be the hallmark of my work was setting out to prove that racial injustice can be an investigative beat, that it doesn't have to be a beat that just catalogs the maladies, she says. So often race reporting to me is extremely superficial. It's just the racist of the week. Or black people suffer from XYZ, as if no one is responsible for that suffering. When choosing a school for my daughter in a segregated city, her investigation into racial segregation in New York City schools was published in the New York Times Magazine, where she started work in 2015. Liberal white people around her started to feel morally implicated and sought absolution from her. I was there when a prominent white male journalist awkwardly came up to her at a lunch and told her how difficult it was to make the decision about where to send his kids to school in Brooklyn. Hannah Jones was polite but refused to commiserate. I have no desire to absolve. It is a weight to always be asked to absolve people who you know are maintaining inequality, Hannah Jones says now. Her refusal to absolve others has been tested again with 1619. She has been, in one way or the other, thinking about this project since high school, when Dial gave her Before the Mayflower, a seminal history of the Black American experience by Lerone Bennett, Jr. Hannah Jones says she had no idea black people had been here that long. But something shifted when I read that date. It stood in for the power of erasure, but also our legacy here. Ahead of the 400th anniversary of the American arrival of the first enslaved Africans, she pitched an entire issue that would challenge the official narrative of the American Project, something that would explore the relationship between slavery and modern capitalism and black Americans' role in democracy. The next year, the New York Times Magazine published it. The reaction was immediate. Considerable praise from readers, long lines for copies, sold-out vendors online and around the country. Then came the open letter from five historians, including respected Princeton history professor Sean Willance. The historians argued against her premise that maintaining slavery had been a motivating factor for the American Revolution. There already had been serious criticism of the work from Native Americans and the World Socialist website about indigenous and class erasure, but this was different. It was all that was needed to unleash the bad faith attacks, Hannah Jones says. Then it just started getting absolutely insane. Though her 1619 essay won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for commentary, some critics still want to dismiss the entire project because of debates over her assertions that American colonists who wanted independence from Britain wanted to protect slavery, and that black freedom struggles had been primarily made up of black people. Hannah Jones updated her essay to clarify that some of the colonists were motivated by slavery and maintains the accuracy of the second statement. Others manipulate it as part of an agenda, which includes critical race theory, to claim that white children need to be protected from alternate narratives of American history, from having their feelings hurt by it, from being made to feel guilty. Nicole is a symbol for people, says the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, her friend and collaborator, and a Vanity Fair contributing editor. Part of that is being a black woman, being so strident, being so proud, so effective. She does not back down. She's intelligent. She has this command of the facts. She doesn't trip over her words. Then you see that the craft is actually behind it. On the other hand, he continues, I think she attracts a great deal of racism and sexism in a way that I just never did, not even close. And a large part of that is just her being who she is. She just attracts a tremendous, tremendous amount of hate. It pained him, he says, to watch the disingenuous creation of a controversy and the disrespectful reduction of Hannah Jones's work, especially by historians like Willance. I'm not saying that essay is unimpeachable, and none of the stories have any flaws in them, but that was just total bullshit. I think so much of this was just about those white liberals needing to feel like they were heroes of American history, and Nicole's just got no time for that. My regret was that I felt so personally invested in defending the project that I didn't care if you had 10 Twitter followers. If you said something about the project that I felt was untrue, I was going to argue with you about it and try to eviscerate you because I was wounded, Hannah Jones says. I regret it because I allowed people to weaponize my own self against me and my work. You forget it's really not the real world. The people whom I did the project for, black folks, folks who have an open mind, they weren't seeing the project as being discredited, but in my mind, the attacks were being successful. To cope, Hannah Jones started doing what many overwhelmed people did during the lockdown. She started drinking too much, developed a short temper, obsessively checked social media, and stopped responding to friends who tried to check in. Behind her fight, she is exceedingly sensitive. She is an Aries, after all. I don't necessarily believe in God, but I do believe in the Zodiac, Hannah Jones says. She decided to take a few Twitter breaks, stop drinking for a while, and focus on answering her critics with this anthology. She read several books on the American Revolution, like The Negro in the American Revolution by Benjamin Quarles, Forced Founders by Woody Holton, The Internal Enemy by Alan Taylor, The Counter-Revolution of 1776 by Gerald Horn. Slavery, Propaganda, and the American Revolution by Patricia Bradley. Slave Nation by Alfred Blumrosen. These Truths by Jill Lepore. and others. She also consulted historians like Eric Foner, Alan Taylor, Martha S. Jones, and Chris Bonner. She still receives hateful tweets and emails, messages full of racial slurs, but takes solace in the life choices she has made. "The benefit of living in the neighborhood that I live in is y'all ain't coming here," she says, laughing. But Hannah Jones had a bad feeling about her tenure at UNC, her alma mater, which had offered her an endowed professorship at its journalism school. Despite Hannah Jones's accomplishments, prizes, and recognition, the board initially didn't grant her tenure, an unprecedented stance toward people who have held that position. It had been a year of unprecedented undermining. A Times opinion columnist, Brett Stevens, published an op-ed denouncing 1619, the work of a fellow Times journalist. The co-chair of the Pulitzer Board, Stephen Hahn, told the Washington Post he had reservations about Hannah Jones receiving the prize, contravening a custom of confidentiality. "People have felt a need to be frank to put me in my place," she says. Still, she accepted the contract. She was tired of fighting and wary of more negative publicity that conservatives could use against her. But the news that UNC would not give her tenure broke anyway. "I was just exhausted, and I was like, this is exactly why I just accepted it," she recalls. "But then the next day, I did what I do, which is, how can I get vengeance?" She got it. After reports emerged about how a multimillionaire donor and the journalism school's namesake, conservative Arkansas publisher Walter Hussman, had opposed her hiring in emails to UNC leaders, Hannah Jones announced that she would ultimately not join the school. Instead, Howard University hired Hannah Jones as a chair in race and journalism, and hired Coates as a chair in English. Hannah Jones is also founding a center there for journalism and democracy that will train young reporters. The tenure affair, though, revealed the tensions between black middle-class concerns and black working-class ones, and raised criticism of the media obsession with Hannah Jones's career brawls. "I was surprised that anyone cared about my tenure issue," she says. "When it comes to black struggles, me getting tenure is nowhere on the list." The reality for most black women professors is bleak. Adjunct lecturers can only teach for 7 years at Howard and were paid an average salary of $49,879 for the 2018-2019 school year. Black women make up only a little more than 2% of tenured faculty in general. The role Hannah Jones is taking on at Howard is a victory of representation rather than of material benefit for the most vulnerable of black labor in academia. After Hannah Jones received the MacArthur Award in 2017, she got another tattoo, Waterloo, her hometown, on her wrist. "I say it's my bitch be humble tattoo," she says with a snort, "because you came from the dirt. To the dirt you can be returned." The spirit of that tattoo is the same attitude that gives a shit about what you think about her work, but not about the woman herself. I know that makes some people uncomfortable. They expect a certain refinement or a certain holding back when you get to be in the position that I'm in, she says. When not writing or tweeting, Hannah Jones loves shopping, naming favorites that include Fendi, ALC, and Rihanna's Fenty line. When she wanted designer clothes as a girl, her mom offered to give her the money she would have paid for affordable clothes if Hannah Jones came up with the difference. She still reads fiction. Recent favorites are Caitlin Greenidge's Liberty and Honoré Fanon Jeffers's The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois, and in Better Times, Throws Parties. Her black genius and house parties, where black journalist friends and I ran into guests like the director Barry Jenkins, ate fried chicken, drank whiskey, and danced to trap music, are some of my favorites. Besides the book, the documentary series, and Howard, She is starting a free after-school literacy program focused on Black American history in Waterloo, where teachers have introduced the 1619 curriculum to their classes. Hannah Jones is no longer the underdog, something she has to make herself remember. I am still, in many ways, this girl from nowhere who had to prove myself in every space I've ever been in, she says. And I always feel like I have to fight and defend myself, even when I'm at a point when I don't have anything else to prove. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A and Vanity Fair Part B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.